This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 101st in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm pleased to do a roundtable today with some of the members of the newly formed Center for Secure Design. So thanks for joining us, guys.
Glad to be here.
Good to be here.
Thank you. Good to be here.
The newly formed IEEE Center for Secure Design was officially launched in August 2014. The CSD will gather software security expertise from industry, academia, and government and provide guidance on recognizing design flaws and designing security in. Today, we'll chat with three of the 13 founding members of the CSD. First is Jim Del Grosso. Jim, who we call Del, is the executive director of the CSD and is a principal at Cigital, where he leads the architecture practice. Del participated in Silver Bullet episode 100, which you can watch on the net now, by the way. Yoshi Kono is an associate professor of computer science at the University of Washington. His work focuses on computer security for emerging and consumer technologies, as well as computer security education. Yoshi participated in Silver Bullet episode 93 at the end of last year. Christoph Kern has been an information security engineer for a decade at Google. He grew up in Germany and studied at the University of Würzburg and also the University of British Columbia. So thanks for joining us, guys. So let's start with Del. Del, as we call you around here, we call you Del, not Jim, where did the notion of the CSD come from and why is it important?
So as you know, you've worked with IEEE for a number of years. And at the tail end of 2013, Kathy Clark Fisher and you started kicking around some ideas about starting a new initiative. And Kathy wanted to start a cybersecurity initiative and was looking for ideas of what that initiative should try and tackle. And what you guys came up with was this notion of what are some of the problems that have been lingering around for years or quite frankly, decades. They haven't been solved, so they must be pretty difficult to solve. And is there something that we can do to maybe try and solve those problems? And the focus of this new initiative should have been or should be on looking at weak designs. And with those parameters, the Center for Secure Design was born with the idea to let's try and do something and prevent software from being built with flaws and design flaws built right into them. So that's kind of how it began.
So we make a distinction in the CSD work between implementation bugs and design flaws, both of which are software defects. Who wants to explain the difference with some examples? Anybody? I'm going to make Del do it since he's sitting right next to me.
So I'll offer up a couple of easy ones that we see occur in real life. So a type of a security defect is using a security control incorrectly. So maybe you're using a cryptographic primitive, but you're using the wrong primitive for what you're trying to accomplish. So imagine you're trying to prevent the tampering of data, but you're using a confidentiality control. That's a design flaw. It's a broken design. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be caught by static analysis. It's probably very difficult to find with dynamic analysis. You really need to look at the design of the application to recognize this is not the right control for the right purpose.
Okay, so to contrast that with a bug that you might normally find in a software problem.
Okay, so keeping with the crypto universe, an implementation bug might be using an incorrect key size or, of course, the classic example of any kind of a buffer overflow or a SQL injection where just the way a developer wrote the code, they have created a defect, but it's really an implementation bug. How the developer chose to implement a feature created the vulnerability. It was a developer's choice of how to write the code, and they created the vulnerability.
Okay, so we're focusing on flaws, and I have a really, really simple example, which I always use because I give a lot of public talks. to lots of people, and this one's really easy. So here's a flaw. Are you ready? Forgot to authenticate user. So that's a really simple one, and it's obvious that when you stare at the code, you're not going to find that flaw. You have to consider the architecture in order to get to that flaw. Yoshi, do you have an example of a design flaw that you think would help people figure out what we're going after with the CSD?
Actually, as you were talking, one of the ones that came to my mind before you were talking was also the failure to realize the need for authentication. And for me, oftentimes it is has to do with a failure to realize the need for something, or as Dell said, using the wrong component. So for example, Dell made a good example of using encryption when one really needs authentication, but sometimes we see systems where, you know, people didn't realize they needed encryption or cryptography at all, or as you pointed out, didn't realize the need for authentication. Another example that I think many listeners are probably familiar with is the unfortunate practice of some servers not storing hashed passwords, but just storing passwords in the clear text. To me, that's an example of a design flaw because of a failure to realize the need to kind of protect those passwords.
Okay, those are good. Christoph, do you have a favorite example of a design flaw? Maybe one that's related to bugs, so we can get to some distinction between bugs and flaws.
Yeah. So I guess one sort of, I'm going to make this a little bit more complicated, right? Because I think what also is important to realize that many classes of bugs are actually in some way manifestations of design level issues.
Absolutely.
And this is an area I've spent a lot of time on, right? So yeah. You can say, for instance, a buffer overflow is really a bug, right? There is a specific line of code that is wrong, and you can often find it through testing, fuzz testing, static analysis. But if you look at the problem of having this class of bugs in the bigger picture, it can happen all over the place in a given large piece of program or a large piece of software. And
because the stack grows really, up, you know, that's it was a design issue on the chip.
Exactly, right? And well, I mean, so really what it comes down to is in some way it's actually a question of language design, right? And I think your recent episode with Michael Hicks talked about that quite a bit, right? So if you use a memory safe language, you won't have this class of bug, and if you use C, you will, right? If you write any non-trivial program in C, you're going to have buffer flows, period, unless you go to great length and formally prove it correct or something like that.
Right.
And this goes for other classes as well, right? So like cross-site scripting bugs, for instance, are in one way very simple and straightforward and trivial bugs. There is a specific piece of code that you can point to where a developer forgot to appropriately validate or encode or escape a string that is somehow placed into, say, an HTML markup context. But at the same time, this is also a design-level issue. You're not going to get rid of XSS bugs unless you look at the design of the APIs and template systems, for instance, that you use to produce HTML markup.
Yeah, so I actually want to go into that with you later on, but those are two very good examples of bugs and flaws. I think it's important to understand that sometimes when you work on design, you can really help to address entire swaths of bugs. So that was exactly the answer I was looking for. Thanks, Christoph. So, Yosh, I have a question for you. Why are flaws a challenge to find and, more importantly, to fix as opposed to, say, bugs?
That's a very good question, and I suspect that all of us might have different answers to that or multiple perspectives. One of the things for me is that very oftentimes the flaws arise because of the worldview of the people who are designing the system. And, you know, in many cases, you know, the systems I've looked at and also interacting with students and so on, the flaw manifests really because the designers didn't think to ask the question. And if you begin, setting out the requirements for the system, designing it, implementing it, and so on, without having asked the question of, you know, what happens if this arises, or do we need this particular aspect of the system to be hardened in such and such a way, or, you know, what about this type of an attacker? To me, I've seen a number of systems where, you know, that just kind of comes out of left field, and so the designers didn't think about it, and so throughout the whole process of creating the system, people just weren't looking in that spot. So I think that's one of the things that pops out of my mind in the answer to your question.
I think that's true. I think there's something maybe even simpler, too, which is For some languages, at least, you can use a static analysis engine, which is automated to look for bugs, but nobody's figured out how to automate looking for flaws yet, as far as I know, mostly because we don't have a description that's formal enough of design these days. People have tried. UML was a shot at that, but it didn't really work. And so in some sense, we can automate one problem and not automate the other. Christoph, do you have anything to add with regard to why flaws are a challenge and why they may be more difficult to fix?
Yeah, I mean, they're kind of more transcendental in a way, right? So, I mean, another one, when you asked the earlier question about examples of flaws, one I was going to mention there is if the design manifests a misunderstanding of the trust boundaries that are inherent in the system, and for instance, makes the inappropriate assumption that it can trust values that it receives from a piece of code that actually runs in an untrustworthy environment. So a typical example would be you have a client-server application or a web application, and the server side that runs in your trusted environment assumes that values that it receives from a client that's actually under the control of a potential attacker are trustworthy in some way, for instance, have already been pre-validated or pre-sanitized or something, then you're going to have a bug. And that's really sort of a very, very, very high-level problem in the overall architecture of the system and how it's broken up into components it's just very hard to in any way automatically reason about, right? I mean, you really have to understand the threat model and you have to understand the assumptions about the trust in the various components and where they're going to be running. And as far as I've seen, there's really no practical way of formally describing that and then or in any way capturing that and then automatically reasoning about it, right? Mm-hmm. And even manually reasoning about it is difficult.
Yeah, it is difficult. And in fact, you know, one of the reasons for this workshop is that this problem has been around for a long time, and there are a bunch of people that are quite expert at thinking about security at the design level. Usually they're pretty good architects in the first place. But still, it's a challenge, and it's an open problem that we haven't been able to scale very well. So I want to change tacks a little bit. Del, can you tell us who attended the first workshop and how the workshop was organized and a little bit about the notion of bringing your bag of flaws along as the ticket to get in or something?
Sure. So bear with me. There was 13 attendees at the initial workshop. So there was myself who was there. Yoshi and Christoph as well were there, as was Gary. In addition, we had Danny Dillon. We had Margo Seltzer. We had Neil Daswani, Jacob West from HP, Brooke Schoenfeld, Ivan Arce from the Fundacion Sadowski, Izar Tarndak, Carl Landwehr, and Diomaitis Spinellis were the attendees. If you know some of these people, great. These folks were from various, you know, commercial and private industry. We straddled government, public and private sector. We came from a lot of different backgrounds.
And but a lot of real commercial guys.
There was a lot of commercial representation. And really, the singular homework assignment that was handed out without anybody being able to coordinate with each other, because no one really knew who was going to show up at the initial workshop, the homework was bring with you the most common design flaws that you find either in your environment or ones that you thought were very important that you quote, see them out in the wild. And the 13 folks brought their own list. And ironically, there were a common set of design flaws that we settled on, and we came up with the 10 most common design flaws, and we started to document what is it about these design flaws? What do they look like? What are some ways to identify them? What should you be thinking about when you're designing your new application, or even as you've designed one of your existing applications, what could you be on the lookout for to avoid the things that we have lived through here in real life? So we wanted people to avoid the problems that we've seen or we had made.
So everybody dumped out their bag of flaws on the collective table, And then we got out a metaphorical bulldozer just to really push the limits of this metaphor and bulldozed around the flaw piles until we said, oh, look, there's the 10 biggest hills. Now let's try to describe those. So we, as Del said, identified the top 10 flaws using our real data pile and then fleshed out how to avoid them. Christoph, can you explain why a list like this could be helpful in your work and in other people's work when they're thinking about design?
Well, I think it it gives you, especially if you if you're for instance a smaller organization that might not have a an in-house mature security program that helps you along with these, it gives you something to start with, right?
I mean, right.
If you're say a small development shop and you sort of realize you need to worry about security, what you might end up doing is you look on the web and you end up finding a bunch of lists of bugs, right? And then your mindset becomes, well, I need to worry about XSS and buffer overflows, and so you get sort of down to this nitty-gritty detail. But then you might actually end up overlooking a much more important and much more prevalent, and then also much harder to fix design level problem in your application.
I think that's exactly right. You know, I've found in my work that design flaws and implementation bugs come about 50-50. Although we find lots more bugs in practice these days, just because we, as we've said before, it's a little bit easier to do.
Right, and I think so. Having this list gives you a starting point to ask at least the right questions, right? And to be honest, there are some of these items that we talk about in this material where really, you know, there's no way to actually teach somebody who doesn't have already a very substantial background in security what to do, right? I mean, so if you look at cryptography, for instance, if you were to sum up that chapter, it's basically you really need to talk to an expert, right?
Go, I mean, get
if you're
Yoshi.
Going to use crypto in any kind of out of the ordinary way, which basically means unless it's like your browser talking SSL or your application talking, getting a browser to talk SSL or HTTPS to a server, you probably really need to talk to an expert, because there's a high chance that you'll make a mistake that you aren't even aware of, right? And there's just really no way around that. It's just very, very complicated.
Sure.
But at least it'll sort of hopefully make people aware of the kinds of problems that can arise and perhaps seek advice from somebody that can help them.
So, Yosh, I want to ask you a little bit about the same thing. You know, we have this top 10 flaws list now. How do you think that could be helpful in an academic setting?
I think that's a very good question. I think part of what the Center for Secure Design did is they identified, as you said, you know, the big mounds or the big areas where design flaws can arise. And, you know, as Christoph was talking, I completely agreed with him that this is a great checklist for a company, you know, large or small, to actually go through and just, you know, kind of make sure you dot your I's and cross your T's and think about all these things. In an educational context, you know, we are producing, you know, students who will eventually be in the workforce. Maybe they will be managers. Maybe they will be, you know, be people that are implementing systems, but these are the issues that the Center for Secure Design recognizes being some of the top issues that are design flaws that people need to consider. And so I think educating people earlier, you know, early and often, as they say, on these issues is very, very useful. And so, you know, the Center for Secure Design is just launching. We've just assembled these things, and I haven't taught a course since that time yet, but I can certainly imagine structuring different components around the course to make sure that we do hit each of these objects or each of these major issues in an undergraduate setting.
Right.
And basically to make sure that the students are prepared to proactively think about potential design flaws when they're in the workforce.
I think that's good, and I think it helps to counter some of the misconceptions about the idea of looking for bugs only and declaring something safe when you don't find any bugs. Christoph, I wanted to give you an opportunity to dig a little bit more into the cross-site scripting stuff that you were talking about at the top of the show. Explain how some of your work focuses on XSS at the design level.
Right. So basically, the problem in practice with XSS, as I mentioned, it's a really relatively straightforward bug, right? And for the most part, the rules about avoiding it, how you need to sanitize or escape data before you use it in a web platform context, like in HTML markup or pass it to a DOM API are relatively simple. There are some sort of tricky corner cases, but for the most part, it's not that complicated. The problem with XSS or with this class of bug in general is that they can arise there's a huge potential for this bug to arise everywhere in a large program, right? I mean, in a typical web application, it's going to be interacting with the web platform with these APIs pretty much everywhere, and so pretty much everywhere you have this potential for bugs. And so what that leads to is that in practice, it basically seems not sufficient, or it just doesn't work to try and go after these bug instance by instance through testing, fuzz testing, static analysis. You're always going to have some left over. And what it also means is that you will not have a high degree of confidence in the absence of these bugs. And so what we've been trying to do is sort of redefine the problem a little bit and design wrapper APIs for the web platform, for instance, HTML rendering, as well as other areas, for instance, for SQL query APIs that are inherently safe, which means that application code that uses our wrapper API actually can't have a bug by the design of the API. And what that does then is that it effectively confines the potential for bugs into a very small proportion of the overall code base. It's basically the implementation of the wrapper API, the safe template system that we're using, and potentially some small bits of application code that needs to get an exception because it wants to do something that can't be expressed in the inherently safe API. And so we can basically restructure our applications such that we do reduce the potential for bugs, and more importantly, we get a much higher confidence in the absence of bugs. We can reason about the existence or non-existence of this class of bugs because we've confined its potential into a much smaller portion of the overall code base.
That's great. Thanks very much. We'll be right back after this message. This is Gary McGraw, your host for the Silver Bullet Security Podcast. If you like what you're hearing here, you should check out my monthly security column published by Search Security and Information Security Magazine. You can find the most recent column at searchsecurity.com/McGraw. All of my writings are collected on my webpage at www.sigital.com/gem/writings. Thanks for listening. I know that, Dell, this is something that you've seen in practice that kind of drives you crazy. Because of exactly what Christoph was saying, you know, people spend so much time looking for instances of cross-site scripting when they could make a design change and fix things, or at least, you know, approach it several different ways from a design perspective. You see that all the time, right?
I mean, I have to say,
I do, and not just, I mean, not just cross-site scripting. Of course, this applies to a number of different types of bugs, and we see these things show up with elements like cross-site request forgery to a lesser degree. It actually, one of the interesting things that I think might be happening with some of the bugs we're seeing is that frameworks are providing capabilities to developers that allow them to get a security control almost for free. So whereas, you know, the .NET platform and Ruby on Rails have now, well, .NET has had it for a lot while, but you've got these protections built into the framework that allow you as a developer to avoid certain types of bugs by using the capabilities of the framework. That almost seems to be the kind of model we need to try to drive towards, that we make some of the security choices for developers easier so that they don't shoot themselves in the foot as often. And that will solve many of these instances of bugs because they're simply going to code things the right way, and we're going to help them code things the right way.
So, Christoph, did you have something that you wanted to add?
I was going to add that I think the tricky bit, of course, in doing this is to design these APIs so that developers actually want to use them, right? So they have to be easy to use and not sort of drastically alter the accustomed development flow that developers in your organization are used to, right? So, I mean, there has been work that, for instance, demonstrated that you can have safe HTML construction in I think there was a paper where they used they basically used types in ML, right? And so that works, but it's not practical because people want to write HTML using templates, right? And so you have to work within the existing culture. The flip side is that you can often actually leverage this, right? So we actually found that that a lot of the tooling that we needed really was already there because the development teams or the infrastructure teams already had built, for instance, static checking tools, or for instance, Google. In Google, the JavaScript is basically a statically typed language, and it's all compiled. And so we already had the hooks there in the JavaScript compiler, which is actually open source as Clojure compiler, to allow us to, for instance, restrict use of unsafe or potentially unsafe coding constructs, like use of eval and direct assignments of arbitrarily or ad hoc constructed strings to inner HTML and so on. And so you kind of have to work within the existing development culture or the existing software quality process and sort of tack on the things that you want for security. And then I think that's what allows you to make this actually successful in practice, right? If you try to completely change the paradigm, people will resist.
Yep, I think that's right. So I want to switch gears a little bit, but also talk about some real world flaw stuff. Yosh, you've done a lot of work on automobile security. Have you seen any evidence of design flaws in addition to the bugs in these systems that you guys have written about?
Oh yeah, so I think that we definitely see evidence of design flaws. Actually, you know, for automobiles and also many of the other technologies that we've looked at, for example, medical devices, electronic voting machines, and so on. You know, one of the things that we saw when we analyzed the automobile's internal computer network was that there was really no authentication between any individual components. And so, you know, backing up a little bit, for those of you who are not familiar with the automotive environment, in an automobile you'll have multiple components, computerized components, and they're talking with each other. For example, you'll have a computer that controls the brakes, a computer that controls the door locks, you have a computer that controls the car's telematic system, and so on. And there's a number of safety reasons for them to talk with each other. But you know, an example of a design issue that we saw when looking at the vehicle was that there was no authentication between, or essentially no authentication between the components. And so any other computer on that network, you know, perhaps an adversarially installed computer, could just send messages to other computers within the vehicle.
That's a really good example. So now we know what a flaw is. We have some real examples. We've discussed some of the relationships between bugs and flaws. Dell, can you tell us what the release plan is for this top 10 flaws document, where people can find it, and when and where the launch event happens?
So the launch event is going to happen on Tuesday, August 26th. That's when we'll officially release it. And you can go to the website on cybersecurity.ieee.org for information about the top 10 flaws that we documented, and you'll also be able to basically talk or submit an email to Kathy and get involved if you're interested.
So Yoshi, can you explain very briefly the process by which we took our list of flaws and fleshed each of the top 10 out? And then while you're at it, why do you think nobody's done that before?
Okay, well, I'll start with the first one. The process was, as you kind of mentioned, at first we were at the meeting all co-located and intensely working on, well, what are the flaws, grouping them in different areas. And then we broke off into groups with multiple different perspectives represented in each group, but people involved on, with interest in some specific topic. And so, for example, cryptography would have a couple of people, or I guess three or four people involved, and we would really look at and focus on the cryptographic issues. And what we did is we, within each small group, we took this broader issue of, you know, a design flaw of failure to use cryptography correctly, and kind of worked through what are the exact actual examples of this type of flaw, how do we best convey it, and how would we recommend people, to do in order to mitigate this potential, address or mitigate this potential issue. And we would iterate internally within our group to kind of surface all the important points that need to be addressed for that flaw, and then actually write out a section that covers it. And then the entire group of participants for the Center for Secure Design then took the whole document and, you know, it was up on a Google Doc. We took the whole document and all went effectively multiple passes through it, trying to comment on each other's sections, clarify things, and so on. And so at the end of the day, this really is a joint document produced by all of us kind of growing up with key focuses on specific areas and then broadening it where all of us looked at the entire document.
Thanks. And why do you think, you know, we haven't had a top 10 flaws list before?
Yeah, so to the best of my knowledge, again, as you said, this is the first kind of compiled, made available to the public top 10 flaws list. I'm not sure exactly why this didn't arise. I suspect that you and Christoph and Dell and I have internally kind of had our own top 10 flaws list that we've known about. But I think that, you know, it took this effort that Dell talked about at the beginning where the IEEE comes in and we are going to do a service for the community where we take this knowledge that has been kind of developed within, that experts within the community already had maybe informally and kind of synthesized it together into something that we can then make available for the broader community.
Cool. Thank you. Dell, what are your plans for the future of the CSD?
So post-launch, there's another workshop planned in the November timeframe, which is going to focus on medical devices, which will dovetail into the initial workshop that we've had. For the next 2 years, we're going to continue to have workshops and broaden basically the level of detail that we go into each of these flaws. So we want to create the idea of these building blocks. We want to create usable information that basically anybody in the world can come to this site, get some information about these flaws, and get actionable advice on what can they do to avoid these problems. So we've got the shell built with this first workshop, and really the next couple of years and hopefully beyond is going to drill down into these topics. Maybe the list will of course change over time as if, heaven forbid, we start to solve some of these problems. That would be nice. But we hope to have, you know, actionable advice that people can look at this and say, oh, I hadn't really thought about that, you know, that aspect of this, you know, security control. Let me go think about that. Let me go design my system to avoid these flaws in the future. And that's really what we want to do over the next couple of years.
And you said that the CSD is open for others to get involved. So if you're interested, make sure to contact us through the websites that we'll have links on the podcast page and also through the website that was mentioned before. So final question for all three of you, one at a time, of course. Do you believe we can make as much progress or as little if you're a pessimist on design flaws as we have over the last decade on security bugs and automation? So Dell, you first.
So I think we can make more progress going forward than we have made because I'm in the camp where I don't think we've made much progress at all. The same flaws that we've known about for probably 30 plus years continue to persist at an incredibly alarming rate, and I only think we can get better at this. So I'm very optimistic moving forward, but I think history has been very bad to us.
Yeah, and you know, we've mostly approached things through security design principles for the most part. So I think getting a little more concrete might help. What do you think about the same question, Yosh? Do you think we can make as much progress on design flaws as we have on security bugs over the last decade?
I think that's a really good question and a really tough question. You know, I'm kind of coming back to one of the things that you and Christoph talked about earlier in the fact of automated tools to assist in the analysis of both design flaws and bugs. I think it's really tough. I'm going to remain optimistic, thinking that we can make a lot of progress. But I think that there are a number of challenges, and to me, one of the different challenges is that there are lots of different environments where there are lots of different issues, where a diverse type of issues arise. And so, for example, you know, while a C program might look the same, whether you're working on an embedded environment to, you know, desktop environment to something else, the issues surrounding, the design issues surrounding, you know, all these variety of technologies in our environment, ranging from like the Google Glass to the desktop computer to the, you know, the stereotypical example, the toaster oven to the automobile. So lots of different environments. My feeling is if we pick one type of environment and can, you know, really focus deeply on design issues in that environment, you know, we will be able to make lots of progress. But I did want to kind of bounce back and say there are lots of environments to think about.
Yep.
And pretty diverse.
Very good. So, Christoph, in 10 words or less, what's your answer to that question?
Yes, I think actually I was going to talk about the same thing that Yoshi mentioned at the end.
Oh, I'm sorry. You've run out of words.
Okay. All right.
No, not kidding. I'm just kidding. Go ahead. What were you going to say?
So talking about design issues in the abstract is very difficult, and it really in practice takes experience to actually map that to a real specific design. But I think there's an opportunity to do this work, this mapping, for specific classes of applications, right? And a lot of applications fall in some class, right? A web app usually has a particular kind of architecture, and there's sort of a threat model that goes with it. And same goes for a mobile app that maybe talks to a network-based backend, and maybe the same is true for medical app, medical devices or automotive devices and so on. And so I think there might be an opportunity to basically map these design considerations to those specific classes of applications, and then manifest them in specific advice, and maybe also, as Dell mentioned, even in specific guidelines for the frameworks that these applications typically use to already take care of particular security concerns, both at a design and a bug level, for that class of applications. I think we can make a lot of progress in that area.
Cool. Well, thanks, guys. I really appreciate your participating today.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. The July-August 2014 issue of IEEE S&P Magazine is a special issue on surveillance, which includes an editorial by Susan Landau. The issue also includes our conversation with Nate Fick, CEO of Endgame. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.